Donc nous allons continuer sur les données massives et leur collecte avec ce qui se passe en Angleterre. Donc Thomas Nichols qui va nous parler en anglais. Mike Brady plus tard nous parlera en français, mais Thomas Nichols va nous parler en anglais. Donc de ce qui se passe à Oxford Big Data Institute en particulier.
Ouais, Thomas. Thank you and sorry for speaking English. My high school French does not take me very far. So I'm pleased to tell you about a couple things. I will tell you about the institute, which is a new institute at the University of Oxford, where I'm coming from. And I'll take some time to explain these new data sets that are coming online and are available. And I think they're really interesting, and I'll tell you a lot about their characteristics. And then I'll tell you about two directions that I'm interested in pursuing and have been working on motivated by these data sets. So the real challenge of big data in the biomedical setting is to integrate all the different types of data that are available. And so this includes information that comes from the state, from the doctor's records where you're actually being treated, from the hospital PAC systems, but also information about what you're exposed to in your environment, and information in about your employment records, everything basically. So to address these challenges, the University of Oxford created the Big Data Institute. It was just opened this past year, and there are four areas of focus at this center. One is on cohorts. I don't have a mouse. I guess I'll use this. One is on cohorts. So these are the different large-scale data sets that are motivating this. I'll say a lot about the UK Biobank, but there's an analogous project that's being run from Oxford in China, as well as a number of other projects. There are the people that are working on how to develop the imaging, the particular technologies involved in creating the phenotypes, whether that's imaging or genomic or harvesting information from health records. I'm sorry, the resolution is limited here. I work in this kind of area, which is basically developing statistical methods that work on the imaging data or integrate multiple sources of data together to learn information. And another important part, which I also work in, is data access and sharing. So one of the things that sets apart the UK Biobank is that the data is relatively easily accessible, and we have people that focus on the ethical issues of consent and what can be done with this data, as well as developing standards to make it easy to use as much of this data as possible. So that's where I'm coming from. My particular focus is on the brain. And the thing I'll be talking about is functional magnetic resonance imaging. If you're not aware of it, it's a really fascinating technique that allows us to see what is going on inside the brain due to this simple fact that as blood changes from blue to red, as it loses oxygen, it turns out that the magnetic properties of blood also change. So we have an endogenous tracer in our blood. We don't have to inject anything. We can actually use MRI to get images where the image intensity tells us about the local blood flow, blood volume, and oxygenation. And so if we do a simple task, say if someone tapping their fingers versus rest, in parts of the brain responsible for moving your fingers, you'll see a up and down signal. Now, almost no one does experiments that are that boring. The psychologist developed very complicated experiments, say with three different conditions and different controls, and then it's up to people like me and statisticians and other people to develop the models that will explain this data, and then ultimately produce pictures like this that say, where is there evidence for a difference between the experimental conditions? So early in my career, I focused on basically creating these maps. Where is there signal? And where is the there is no signal? Where is the data consistent with noise? And as we'll see, there are some actually problems with that in the big data setting. So is fMRI big data? We recently, with colleagues Russ Poldrack and others, did a literature review to look back. And if you look at the median sample size used in papers by year, doesn't really sound like big data, does it? We broke 20 subjects. Just past 2010. So the typical fMRI studies, in fact, are quite small. And if you then say, well, if I'm looking for a pretty meaty effect size, how many subjects, what sort of effect size would I need to detect? you can see that you, with these median sample sizes, how big of an effect size can I detect with these sample sizes? Well, this is huge. If you know Cohen's D effect sizes, an effect size of 1 is just dramatic, and only recently have we hit the 0.2. And so if you could ask, well, is 0.8 a reasonable effect size? Well, we looked in the UK, a study I'll tell you about, we looked in the Human Connectome Project to see is that a reasonable effect size for functional MRI, and well, sometimes. Sometimes we get up to D equals 0.8, sometimes not. But something that's worth pausing is that an effect size of 0.8 roughly corresponds to an R squared of 13, so that's 13% variance explained. As we're learning in these large-scale studies, you will be very lucky to find an effect that explains 1% of variance. So we actually, if we managed with sample size of 20 to detect 0.8, we're going to need much, much larger sample sizes to detect these very small modulations of these effects that relate to population factors. So the first big neuroimaging project I worked with was the Human Connectome Project. This is 1,200 subjects. This is a proper population sample. It was drawn from birth records in Missouri, and all families that had twins were invited to participate. And from that subset of people, they were later asked to participate in this imaging study. And some of the most cutting-edge, high-resolution, high-time-resolution imaging data was collected using fMRI and resting state fMRI and diffusion MRI. So the incredible imaging data, and also incredible data on behavior, health history, and things about what your parents did. It's quite incredible, and it's actually relatively easy to get access to. If you are at all curious, with one click, you can get almost all the data, and then with signed authorization, you can get the protected information about, say, drug use and medical history, and the data is really, really, really impressive. The data, once I've moved to Oxford, that I've been working with is the UK Biobank. So just a little bit about this. This was created in 2006 initially. 9.2 million people were contacted on the basis of the National Health Service records, where they looked for people who were aged between 40 and 69. And of these 9.2, we eventually got 500,000 individuals who attended an assessment center and went through the baseline assessment. And 5.5% response rate is not bad, apparently, in these settings. So a question we can ask is, wow, this looks like a population sample. So is it representative? Well, what's great is that for almost all of the subjects contacted, we know before they were contacted, we know their sex, year and month of birth, and based on where they live, we know whether they lived in a high socioeconomic status area or a low socioeconomic status area, as summarized by this Townsend Deprivation Index residence. So this work colleagues at the Big Data Institute worked to see what, did we succeed? How representative is the UK Biobank? So if you compare in blue, this is to the people that were invited. So roughly equal numbers of men and women were invited to participate, but way more women responded and joined the UK Biobank. If you look at the distribution by age, more young people were invited, but in fact, more old people responded and joined the UK Biobank sample. Sorry, you can't see this, but this is the deprivation score. So this is low deprivation, high deprivation. So this is nicer area. This is a rougher area. So you can see it was roughly balanced by invitation, but people who lived in the nicer parts of town, nicer parts of the UK, were more likely to respond. Geographically, not so bad. It seems to be roughly matching, slight under response in London and in the Northwest, but a decent sample. So in general, I would summarize it that the UK Biobank is representative-ish. It's certainly more representative than your typical study run at a local college where you just sample 20-year-olds who are undergraduates. But if you look very carefully, there is a slight greater representation of whites, so slightly fewer minorities, and it's slightly more well-off, as reflected probably from that previous statement about the socioeconomic status. 90% own a home versus the last census said 80% of individuals owned a home. Smoking, you can see that, interestingly, they're actually similar for previous, never previous, but the current status. Biobank participants generally have stopped smoking or never have smoking. So they're basically less, there are a lot of stoppers. People who are currently not smoking, fewer of those in the UK Biobank. And in the short time that's been running, we, of course, this is the purpose of an epidemiological study, is to follow people and wait for them to die. They are dying at slightly lower rates than the rest of the population. So again, this is consistent with them being slightly more healthy than the general population as a whole. So again, so it's more representative than probably most things you'll ever touch, but I actually ran into this directly because I submitted my application to the UK Biobank saying I'm very excited to use this representative sample of the UK, and it was immediately sent back to me saying, it's not a representative sample. Please don't say that. So there are over 1,000 variables that have been measured at baseline and then on subsequent follow-up visits. There's something called the data showcase. In fact, if you just Google Biobank showcase, you'll find this link, and it's just fun. You can just link through. So the highest BMI was 44.9. There's a processing speed, fluid intelligence score of a particular variant. Hearing, forced expiratory volume in 1 second, vision tests, blood pressure, heart rate after a challenge. You'll see that the ends all vary. So not everyone, for example, did the vision test. This is a subset of the subjects did a fitness test. So this is, Bertrand mentioned, I even understood that. Bertrand mentioned the issue of missing data. And this is something that you have to deal with in this setting because there's very, very few variables for which everyone has complete data. So additionally, there has been genotyping of all of the UK Biobank subjects. That's 11 million SNPs. It's planned to do full sequencing on all these subjects. And the thing that, of course, I'm excited about is the imaging. So they have received funding from the Medical Research Council and the Wellcome Trust to scan 100,000 individuals. If you go to the UK Biobank website, they have a little odometer clicks over how many people have been scanned. I checked it this morning. We've passed 20,000 people have been scanned, and that data is being made available on a continuous basis every, I think, roughly 6 months. So there's, if you know MRI, there's a T1 weighted, which gives you detailed anatomy, T2 flare. Actually, I think I have a nice picture of this. I'll just go back to that. Susceptibility weighted imaging, diffusion MRI, resting state fMRI, and one task fMRI, a faces versus shapes task. And something that Steve Smith, who's been leading up the MRI of the brain of the biobank, analysis has done is he's distilled all of these measures into 3,000 phenotypes. So the image data is there if you'd like to process it, and we already heard about that from Nicola using that. But if you actually are not an image processing expert and you would just like to get these measures, they're there, they've been QC'd, they're ready to use and to put into your favorite algorithm. Okay, so while the initial study started in 2006, the imaging commenced in 2014. And just to stress, it's not just the brain, there's also the heart, as we've seen. There's also carotid ultrasound and a DEXA scan that tells you about bone mineral density. This work in Oxford has been led by Steve Smith and graduate student Fidel Alfaro Almagro. Really impressive amounts of work. He basically is processing this data every day. Here's some illustration that the T1 lets us find out the structure of subcortical brain volumes as well as the gray matter cortical ribbon. The flare images help us identify these white matter lesions, which you can see. These are things that, something that I'm excited to analyze going forward. We all tend to get these white matter lesions as we get older, but they are associated with stroke and hypertension, and we don't know exactly what all they're telling us. The diffusion MRI, of course, generates a number of different measures as well as basically sort of vector measures, tensors. We have the task fMRI and the resting state data, which is also in there. So one of the things we have to think about when we are analyzing this data, and also Bertrand mentioned this, is the issue of confounds. So from an epidemiology standpoint, people are always thinking about confounds, but there are some ones that are very specific to imaging. And some of the biggest ones are mentioned here, so in particular head motion. It turns out that the amount of the degree to which you move in the scanner is a heritable trait. Some people are good at standing still perfectly, and some people are fidgety and cannot stand still in a scanner. And that has a serious impact on the quality of the images, which is a serious confound. That also the degree, your breathing rate and depth. So this may be related to some issues of claustrophobia. If you're not having a pleasant time in the scanner, you may start hyperventilating. Moving, changing your breathing patterns, that too can affect the image quality and introduce artifacts. And we found that blood pressure and, of course, age is a huge effect. Disappointingly, every time there's even a software upgrade to the scanners, this can have an effect. The UK Biobank is using three different assessment centers. They all have the exact same hardware, but that hardware does get upgraded. And even with these things, even before hardware changes, we even find that there are effects over time, just the way that people are put through the system. Either we don't know what exactly, whether it's personnel who are putting people through differently or whether it's just drift in the machine. The other thing that sort of I found was surprising was that my early career was based on finding where is the signal in the noise and it controlling for the number of tests. But if you do a simple calculation, which is to say, if I'm looking for an effect that explains 1% variance, how many subjects do I need to detect that with 80% power? Now, if you just have one test, you may be surprised to know you need 700 subjects. You need a lot of subjects to detect that. That's not easy to do. But you can then ask, what if I increase the number of phenotypes that I search over, going from, say, 1 to 100, to 10,000, or 1,000, that's 10,000. And look at this curve. So it actually doesn't grow that much. So there are two competing things. There's the additional power you gain with N, and then there's the penalty you have to pay for each additional test that you correct for. And it turns out, in that battle, N beats K. So it turns out that if you, all things equal, if you just square the number of tests that you would like to examine, you only need to double the sample size to maintain the same power. So that surprised me, but it did explain some of the results that Steve Smith and Carla Miller were getting. So here was just their first initial result with only 8,000 subjects, and they created their 3,000 IDPs, image-derived phenotypes, and they related them to all of the different non-imaging measures, so early life factors, lifestyle, life and work, life, food and drink, alcohol, tobacco, general physical makeup like height and weight, cardio, blood assays, everything. And this upper line here is the Bonferroni correction. So they are doing on the order of 3,000 times 2,000 tests, I mean millions of tests, and yet find all these things significant. So this is this N beats K. At some point, the penalty for looking over many tests is going to be dwarfed by the power that you obtain from large N. They've also applied this, so Steve and Jonathan Marcini have done genetic association on the 8,000 sample as well, looking across all the different brain phenotypes. This is a measure of the heritability. Again, I apologize for the quality here, but the heritability is usually about 50% on these things, which is quite good as phenotypes go, and we know brain imaging measures are, in general, very heritable. And they found, this is the most prominent thing they found, was a 10 to the minus 30 hit on diffusion measure, something derived from the diffusion data called intracellular volume fraction. They also found another hit that was very intriguing in the T2 star in the putamen, which related to an iron transport gene. And we know that at 3 tesla, the presence of iron in the putamen does affect the signal strength. So we know there's information about iron in there, and so isn't it nice that they found an association with a gene related to iron transport? So this work is on archive right now, and I think it's nearly accepted somewhere. So that's an overview of the UK Biobank, and so what I would like to do in this brief remaining time is to tell you a couple of things that I've been working on that are motivated by this work. So the first thing is dealing with dependence, but not in space. So the Human Connectome Project is actually, by design, a family study. The subjects are not independent. And something else that people have been noticing in brain in genetics is that even when you get a collection of individuals that are not related, theoretically, they are, well, first of all, you'll find some cousins and even siblings in there. But if you just take all of us in this room, some of you are going to be more genetically similar to some than others. And it turns out that variation in the degree of genetic relatedness is both a confound and an opportunity. It is an opportunity because you can then use that varying degree of relatedness to estimate heritability on what was otherwise an unrelated sample. It also, if you're looking very precisely, it can bias the inferences if you do not control for them. However, this becomes a complicated statistical task to deal with this kind of correlation, and that's what this work that we looked at to take on. So for example, in the Human Connectome Project, where you have the families in a structure that's very prominent, if you ignore this, if you just naively compute an association here, this is between structural measures and intelligence, you get an inflation of the effect size using naive methods relative to methods that are aware of the family structure. And this was using traditional methods in the R software, but this doesn't necessarily scale. So we worked on a problem to deal with this. I won't go into all the gory details, but basically we take a correlated data problem, and because we know the exact structure of the relatedness, whether due to the families or whether due to the genetic relatedness, we can decorrelate or diagonalize this problem and turn what was in a messy correlated data problem into a series of linear regressions, either weighted or unweighted regressions that can be estimated very quickly and allow us to estimate this, what would be otherwise a very tricky problem, speeding it up so we can do it across the image and even do things like permutation. So I'll skip this, but just we showed that it has controls false positive and it has competitive, if not better, power than the traditional methods because it's making weaker assumptions. And crucially, when we compare to the best practice method that's available, something called FastLMM, we're getting sort of computation times in the seconds where there's takes in the hour, again, because traditional genetic methods are interested in working with one phenotype, generally, and we're trying to deal with the fact that we have millions of phenotypes. When we applied this to another large-ish data sample, 300 subjects coming from Maryland on diffusion MRI, I'll just quickly show you the results here. We basically get similar results, but there's an important difference. If you know genetic results, they sometimes look for this general bend in the plot of the p-values. These are the log p-values, and that's known as population substructure, and that's basically saying there's some latent relatedness that probably should be corrected for, and this mixed model approach that we're using corrects for that. And so we get a better sort of p-values when there's nothing going on while still detecting effects when there is an effect to be detected. Okay, and then just quickly, I'll come back to this issue of finding what's signal and what's noise. So that was where I started my career, dealing with multiple testing. But what people have observed that if you have a lot of data, so for example, if you at the NIH, some individuals have somehow convinced people to go into the scanner 100 times, and then you average all that data, you actually will find activation everywhere. So basically, with a hundred scans worth of data, you can find evidence of task-related variability anywhere you want to look in the brain. And likewise, we're going to face this too. This has a name. It's called the null hypothesis fallacy. That with enough data, you'll always have evidence to reject the null, because what is the null hypothesis? The null hypothesis is that the effect is 0.0000000. There is exactly none. And of course, when is there exactly no effect? In the UK Biobank, the faces minus shapes task, here are the maximum T values that we get as we go up from 150, 500, 1,000, and you can see the maximum T value. You probably haven't done a study where you got a T of 144, but that's what you find. Here are the histograms of these too. You know, these just grow dramatically. So the traditional testing where I got my start is could have has a problem because, well, you basically don't need me anymore because we don't have to deal with a multiple testing problem when everything is real. But we still want to make inferences. We still may want to make inferences about where is the activation and where is it not above some criterion. So this leads to some work I've done with Armin Schwarzman at University of San Diego on, let's define a set of where the activation exceeds some threshold. Can we come up with another pair of envelope sets, a smaller set and a bigger set, that will that gives us confidence about where the activation is and where it is not? And one dimension, you can think of it like this. If I have a 1% effect size threshold, these are the usual clusters. I would like to find a red cluster and a blue cluster that tell me where, with confidence over the whole brain, can I be sure that here the activation is definitely better, bigger than this. And interestingly, everything that's outside of the blue, I have the same confidence that the true activation is less than this amount. So I'll make pictures that are colored like this. Just to fill in the details, that the mathematics behind this are actually are complex, but it turns out you can use a resampling technique, and it just depends on the sampling behavior of the residuals at these crossover points. So it actually is not even that computationally intensive. So on the Human Connectome Project, here are two different effects. This is just the raw effect of faces, and here's the effect of shapes. So the yellow would be just the threshold of where is the bold effect showing a 0.5% change. And the red is saying, okay, here I have confidence over the entire 3D image that the effect is at least 5%. And outside of the blue, I have that confidence that the effect is less than 0.5%. And here's the same thing for faces minus shapes. And now we very nicely get the amygdala isolated here. But we now, for this sample size, which was just, I just did this for here on 80 unrelated subjects, you can see there's some uncertainty, basically saying if we repeated this experiment over and over and over again, I could expect this yellow set to bounce around within that blue set. But it should not fall outside of it. It should only fall outside of it less than 5% of the time. On the UK Biobank, you can compare 1,000 and 5,000. And we are seeing that for a very strong effect, in some ways this is a very boring effect, so it's not surprising we have a lot of power, we're actually seeing that these sets start to coincide. But that's informative too. That's basically saying at 5,000 subjects, we've reached a point where there's negligible uncertainty in where the effect crosses, in this case, 2% activation. But there's still some difference. If we look at the volume difference between the inner and the outer set, there's 2,000 pixels, voxels in there. Okay, and so I'll just wrap up. So I just talked about some of the challenges that we're facing. Neuroimaging is coming from a place of being very small data, and it is becoming bigger data. It's still not on the magnitude of many of the traditional machine learning applications where you get millions of clicks a day, if not a second. So I think we always have to recognize that this is a smaller scale than some of the techniques that some of the types of data that have been fed into traditional machine learning methods. Have to deal with the dependence, especially in studies that have that designed in, or if it's just there present due to latent relatedness. And I'm working on methods to basically move us from null hypothesis testing so that we can understand. This was a joke left in from another talk. we all basically have to become, if we're going to use this data, we all have to become epidemiologists and become aware of the techniques that they've been using for identifying and dealing with confounds. So I'll stop there. Thanks.